Hello, Blogging Heads Nation. This is Dresbert. I'm Daniel Dresner. I'm a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy.
And I'm Heather Hurlburt, senior fellow for national security at Human Rights First.
And we are here to talk about our monthly conversation about stuff in the foreign policy news. And the natural place to open with that is the fact that I'm very excited that Game of Thrones is starting next month again, season four.
And I want to say that we are going to have a moment, an incredibly rare moment in the history of national security punditry, where I look at the screen with my big eyes and I say, so I know nothing about Game of Thrones. I have never seen it. I am not an expert on it. I do not have an opinion.
Now, let me ask you a question before I will explain that to you, but I'm kind of curious. Assume for the moment that you were like in an actual professional meeting and this came up. And you had to at least, I assume one of the skills of being down in D.C., no small part, would be somehow to bluff your way through this. What would you say in that instance? Like someone brought up Game of Thrones. How would you somehow try to demonstrate, you know, competence?
Yeah, so Game of Thrones is starting again, Dan. And I think the Game of Thrones phenomenon and the fascination that it has really, you know, gainsays the frequent assertion that the American public doesn't care about strategy. And that what Game of Thrones shows is that, in fact, Americans are deeply attached and just as capable of thinking in long-term strategic ways as people from any other country. We just need it packaged in a way that works for us in our entertainment culture.
You can't see it, but I just bowed down to you. That was awesome.
Thank you.
Was very impressive. Okay, so to fill you in, Game of Thrones, is based on a series of George R. R. Martin novels, which came out about 10 to 15 years ago, which he is still doing. In fact, there is some concern that the show is going to catch up with the books. But essentially, the books are set in this mystical sort of fantasy world that bears an awfully strong resemblance to England during the time of the War of the Roses, in which literally geographically the island of or the land of Westeros literally looks like the land of England. There is a large continent off the way where other intrigue happens. There is also a massive wall preventing, bad things from the north, including apparently zombies, from penetrating Westeros.
Wait, stop. There are zombies in Game of Thrones?
Yes, there are. They're not exactly, they're called the White Walkers, but they're basically in this frozen tundra northland, and you, at least in the show, you see hints of them marching south, and that's one of the big sort of looming crises that is sort of, you know, looming sense of dread that's happening.
Sort of like the Russian military massing on your borders.
There you go.
So follow along at home, folks. Notice that I'm carefully interspersing topical references, getting a sense of how they're relevant. So the next time someone asks me a question about Game of Thrones, I can start with the White Walkers. You said they were.
There you go. White Walkers. Just call them the White Walkers.
And how they're clearly drawing a connection between the threats we feel from amorphous yet felt like terrorism or the Russian army. And on the one hand, drawing back to our sci-fi culture in ways that are immediately accessible to the non-specialist viewer.
Again, I'm just in awe. But the only other element I would add of Game of Thrones that is interesting is that basically it's set up so that it's almost a feudal structure where there are multiple houses that there was a kingdom of Westeros, but as the show has been developing, we're now seeing civil war among the various houses. Oh, and one last thing, the weapons of mass destruction in this world are dragons. And there is one house that has been in exile called House Targaryen. And the leader of that house is slowly plotting to try to get back to Westeros, and she has dragons, which can apparently destroy a lot of things, if potentially. So you're right, actually. You know, the remarkable thing is, I didn't even have to tell you that because you actually made the primary point I would say about Game of Thrones, which is the great thing about Game of Thrones, at least if you're interested in politics, is that it really is all about who actually has something resembling a clear strategy and who doesn't. And one of the ways in which I think the show has actually been very, very clever is that it started off by having you identify with this one particular family called Starks. The Starks are good, honorable, decent, you know, hardworking, unassuming folk of the North that do not have a strategic bone in their body. You will therefore not be surprised to learn that the head of the family, gets beheaded at the end of season one, and a lot of the rest of the family got slaughtered towards the end of season three in a very infamous episode referred to as the Red Wedding.
So we're now going to have to put I said slaughter alert. I meant spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
Slaughter alert note on this episode.
Yes, yes. Spoiler alert.
For those folks who were behind on their DVR watching.
Well, okay, it's been a year, and you know, I'm not going to apologize for that for that spoiler alert, because it's still shocking. Actually, even when there was actually a great Onion headline when the episode came out, which boiled down to George R. R. Martin forgot he wrote Red Wedding, you know, scene in books, shocked by what happens in show. So season four is about to gear up, and again, it's a nice way of, and I gave a talk at Duke actually this last week about what Game of Thrones can teach us in world politics. And I think one of the appeals of genre fiction like Game of Thrones, in a way that I don't think quite works in like shows like either The West Wing or House of Cards, is that precisely because it's genre, you can think about these sort of big strategic questions in a way that if you thought about it in either a straight narrative sense or even in the real world can potentially be off-putting or scary to people.
Yeah, strategy works much better both in real life and in fiction when you don't care about the characters.
Yeah. Or, well, no, you care about the characters, but at the same time...
It's genre fiction. There's a limit to how much you care about the characters.
Yes, exactly. And you also don't see the bloodshed on, you know, necessarily. And you know, you only care about certain characters. You don't care about all of them. And if bad people die, that's it.
Right.
Yes. Yes. But anyway, I am very enthusiastic about the show, even though I have not watched or read the books, which actually leads to this sort of interesting, like, hierarchy of nerds, of wonk nerdom, of basically people who have read the books and therefore have a better sense of what is coming versus those who, you know, have not read the books but are really hooked on the show and don't entirely know what is coming, which I fall into, versus those who have neither read the books nor watched the show, but like you, can passably sound erudite about either.
What I love about it is that I'm like suddenly a nerd among nerds. You know, like you go and hide out with the other nerds and you think that you found yourself a community of other nerds. And then you find out because there's a TV show you don't watch, you're still a damn nerd.
Okay. So we can then start now with a nerd complaint I assume you share with me, which is, in all seriousness, what the hell is going on with news coverage over the last, week or so, more than that, in which literally you can't turn on, you know, cable news without the top story being the missing Malaysian airline.
I actually had an exchange this morning with the host of a cable television news program who said, well, I think perhaps my show will be back on the air next week. So just know that among cable news hosts, there are also suffering wonks
I would say two things on this. The first is, what's particularly vexing about this is that it's not like it's been a boring news, you know, cycle for the last 10 days. A lot of shit has gone down, and actually some really big important shit has gone down. So it's not like there's nothing going on, you know, it's the summer and, you know, politics is not really all that important, and then suddenly, you know, it's Shark Week or something. And don't get me wrong, I think, you know, a missing airliner certainly is provoking some interest, but, you know, I'm mildly appalled that, you know, I don't know, a great power gobbling up territory doesn't rank, you know, as significantly important, or instability in Venezuela or a few other things. But the second thing I will say is that, and I don't mean this as a defense, but clearly I have to assume the producers of these cable shows are not stupid in the sense that they want to get ratings, and this must be driving ratings.
In fact, I also was told that this one time slot, the ratings actually doubled when they started doing all plain all the time. And I think actually, funnily enough, this goes back to your genre fiction point, which is that we Americans are very, very blessed that it's not part of our genre to imagine a great power swooping down and taking a chunk of our territory away from us. Nor are Venezuela or Turkey-style unrest part of our national narrative, which is sort of an interesting thing all by itself. But everybody who's ever flown in a plane hears this story and goes, oh my God. Anyone who's ever picked someone up at an airport sees those pictures of the families and just, you know, it's horrible. And yet you know, most of us don't know those people. Most of us don't fly from KL to Beijing. So it's horror. It's a safe, live, real time little mini dose of horror movie, and so of course it gets huge ratings.
No, I can go for, you're right in the sense of it's simultaneously relatable and yet foreign. You know, the images of that, there was, I saw this clip of, it was a Chinese woman that was clearly just emotionally, totally, you know, bereft, and just, you know, she had to be like literally carried out of the airport, I think, because she was, so distraught. And that's one of those things that simultaneously you can't, you know, not look at, and yet you feel dirty when you do.
Yeah. So since you raised this subject, I'm going to say that we still have no idea. I mean, I don't know if in the last half an hour they've actually verified that they found any wreckage, et cetera, et cetera. So caveats.
Let's assume not. Yeah.
Right. Maybe by the time this is shown, our viewers will know more about it than we did. Hi, viewers. But I do wonder whether this saturation coverage, sort of what effects it's going to have on how we think about security. You know, if it turns out that there was some human evil intent somewhere along the chain that led to this, if it turns out that it was linked to some larger cause, which it's worth noting so far that nobody's claimed credit for it, which fascinates right. me because all the usual suspects would have been falling all over themselves to claim credit for it, you would have expected. So if it does turn out that it was connected with either an individual malefactor or a group, what is the fact that it's so seared into consciousnesses? What happens after that, and what kind of outcry is there? And as people who try to tell ourselves that we make and influence policy not on the basis of what drives TV ratings or of an incident that nothing like it has ever happened before, as far as we can tell, and there's not really a reason to believe anything would again, how on earth could we possibly avoid making policy based on this incident once sort of every man, woman, and child in America has seen all the scenes of it nonstop for 2 weeks?
Well, that's an interesting, I mean, I guess the way I would put it is that oddly enough, this is one of, first of all, I agree with you that, you know, I find, you know, the attempt to find, I think what I find fascinating is the attempt to find some sort of sinister motive at work in terms of what's happened. No, there must be some malevolent, you know, conscious malevolent intent as to why that plane went missing. And it's not to say that I don't think that couldn't have happened. It's just that my natural instinct is to be inclined towards some sort of accident happening, just for, as you say, for no other reason that if it was intentional, why hasn't someone taken credit for it and or explained what happened? Because all you get as a result of this is just mystery. And actually, furthermore, you get some dubiousness if someone were to actually come forward now and say, yes, okay, I was responsible for this all along. In terms of the effect on policy, I'm not sure there is one. There will be that much of an effect, except perhaps to, you know, I think you'll probably see calls for somehow making planes more trackable. You know, I mean, if only the NSA could have tracked the plane the same way it tracks, you know, phone conversations. I can actually see the NSA making that case before Congress or something. I think you'll see an increase in potential surveillance capabilities. The other thing, though, this is the part I find interesting, because Jessica Trisco-Darden wrote a good piece over at the Monkey Cage at the Washington Post, pointing out that one of the security ramifications of this has been just the massive amount of distrust among all the various members of the Pacific Rim, that China is justifiably pissed off at Malaysia for the way Malaysia's handled this. Although I will say, once again, it's a bit rich when the Chinese complain that another government is acting in an opaque manner. You know, India does not want China to send its Navy to investigate where the wreckage, you know, the possible parts of where the wreckage is, because that gets too close to India. And, oh, by the way, interestingly enough, it turns out that the U.S. is actually seen as the nice impartial arbiter in all of this, which is everyone welcomes U.S. involvement. You know, and the NTSB in terms of trying to investigate what happens, which is one of those narratives that apparently does not fit with the other narratives going on in the world right now, such as, you know, Russia annexing the Ukraine or, you know, trouble in the Pacific Rim or what have you. So I think in some ways that actually shows the disconnect between a story that grabs a lot of people's attention and the potential policy implications you could draw from that, which will not be drawn.
Well, I think actually your last point is worth digging into a little bit, because the U.S. is seen in several different ways in this, and that in fact much of the data that is available seems to be available either because our satellites have it or because Boeing, which is a U.S. company, has it about the engines. And there are large swaths of the relevant oceans that our Navy has been out there doing parts of the checking. So it's there is clearly resentment, and you've seen the usual kind of, oh, the U.S. isn't telling us, or, you know, when someone says the Malaysian government did something incompetently, no, it was the Americans who gave us bad information. So you do kind of see in microcosm all the good and the frustration of being the country that's seen as both the technological leader and the arbiter, because mm-hmm. there's an effort to sort of get the impartial arbiter, quote unquote, to be more on your side, the effort to blame the arbiter when you want to deflect blame off of yourself. And then the problem of, well, yeah, so it turns out that actually there is not insignificant surveillance of what was going on with the plane's engines, and it's held by a private company. And what should we do about that?
Although, I mean, has there really been that much blowback against the United States, you know, over this? I mean, it strikes me that the U.S., in terms of like ranking the villains, even, you know, if you have a pretty hostile attitude towards the United States, is ranked pretty far down on the list.
Yeah. I don't argue with that, but I did notice the Malaysian government going out of its way to say, oh, well, it's because the Americans didn't tell us stuff. And it's like,
I see.
Actually,
okay.
Yeah, not so much maybe, but that's just something that inevitably happens. And I mean, it happens in a department. You know, you say of the faculty chair, well, I didn't know when the meeting was happening, or you didn't tell me why you wanted me to come to this meeting, you know, or whatever it is. It's a power dynamic.
That's a fair point.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I find myself disturbed about, which is the Malaysia coverage. I mean, really, you want to talk about a crowding out effect. Every moment that, you know, is being devoted to the Malaysian missing Malaysian plane, which I don't deny is a newsworthy story, but still does not necessarily justify the saturation coverage it's gotten. You know, what stories basically, as near as I can figure out, cable news has enough time for, you know, the Malaysian missing plane, random domestic political stuff, and Ukraine. And that's pretty much it. And so what's missing as a result? You know, what are we not paying attention to that we should be?
Right. Well, just to start with two things I found fascinating, one of which actually has a bizarre missing plane connection, is that there's been a lot of really interesting turbulence in Israeli politics this last week, including the Israeli defense minister reversing himself and saying, oh, maybe now Israel should go it alone and attack Iran, which resulted in a very, very strong statement from the United States saying, is he also said a bunch of other not very kind things about the Israel's American allies. And the State Department just today said, we're still waiting for an apology on this. And that's a huge deal. And in some ways, I actually think it's a good thing that that's not sort of the wall-to-wall cable news story. But the weird plane connection is that the Israeli ambassador to the U.S. went on TV and said, well, you never know, the 777 could be somewhere getting retrofitted for an attack on Israel.
Oh, God.
Which put him right down there with Rupert Murdoch, who suggested that China and Al-Qaeda had teamed up to get the plane and that it was being hidden in Pakistan.
The amount of conspiracy theorizing on this has been, this, in some ways, that's the issue. I suppose the best outcome for the cable news nets is that we never find out exactly what happens to the plane. Because it'll allow massive amounts of, you know, conspiracy theorizing. I'm sorry, I do have to interrupt, by the way, just to, I don't know if you're following the NCAA college basketball tourney.
I am, but I'm not currently following it, so please do give an update.
Duke is about to lose.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, so this is.
And they're losing to, let's see, the school starts with an M.
Yes, it's 14th ranked Mercer College.
Mercer College, yes. My 9-year-old went off to school today, very excited about Mercer and sorry that he wasn't going to get to see the game. So, all right. But by the time this shows, nobody will care about that.
Oh, I disagree. The hatred of Duke in basketball is very, very high. It totally blows my bracket, but still, I did the Mark Lynch actually wrote a great piece last year in Foreign Policy about In fact, the parallels between America in the world and Duke in college basketball.
Yes.
That, namely, they're very competent and yet everyone hates them. But sorry, let's go back to.
Okay, so we'll link to that. But other things, I mean, you know, so I made one nomination. Another sort of really fascinating thing that's happening is there are local elections in Turkey, which there are a lot of questions around. And as if on cue, the possibly fed up because of how much coverage of the missing plane there was, the president of Turkey, or sorry, not the president, prime minister of Turkey, shut down Twitter last night.
Yes, but apparently shut down. Well, first of all, I think we have to give credit. I believe Zeynep Tufekci, and I'm sure I'm mangling her last name, had a extremely prescient op-ed in yesterday's New York Times about, hey, do you know that Twitter might be affecting what's going on in Turkey? And so props to her for almost anticipating what was going to happen.
But wait, second I thought of all, her op-ed was about Nate Silver in 538.
What? No. I thought it was in New York Times.
I'm just kidding. But anyway,
oh, okay,
yes.
Okay, sorry, yeah. Oh, predicted. I see. Yes. The second thing is that, yet, I think the better way to put it is that Turkey attempted to shut down Twitter and failed miserably in the sense of they did, you know, sort of block it. But, you know, very quickly, Twitter, I believe, sent something out saying this is how you can get to Twitter if you're in Turkey. And, you know, that spread like wildfire. And in fact, the number of tweets coming out of Turkey, I think, increased by a factor of five. Last night. And it got to the absurd point, I believe, today where some of Erdogan's defenders of the Twitter ban were tweeting why he was right to have the Twitter ban.
Twitter. Well, I think the thing that's worth sort of noting about this is, as I was giving a presentation recently and got into the endless debate about whether Twitter matters and if so, why. I mean, what's fascinating about Twitter in Turkey is that you actually had the president of Turkey taking to Twitter to obliquely criticize the ban on Twitter instituted by the prime minister of Turkey,
right.
which is a fascinating phenomenon. And the fact that sort of Turks are world renowned. And not always in a good way for their skills with social media and their aggressiveness in using social media platforms.
No, my memory, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, and yeah, I'm old enough to remember this. Back in 2000, when Time was trying to decide who their man of the century was going to be, I believe Ataturk wound up winning the internet poll.
Yes.
Because the Turks basically mounted this incredibly well-orchestrated online campaign to make sure that happened.
Yes, and that still happens with other votes and the members of the Gulenist movement, which is a more traditionalist Islamic movement, have also proven very, very adept at using Twitter. I mean, I would say Ataturk won the internet in 2000, and really since then, all the rest of us are just living in his shadow.
I mean, the only thing I would add about this is the extent to which, well, first of all, will it actually matter in terms of the elections there? Because I think one of the classic mistakes people who talk about social media tend to do is it can certainly get people out on the streets. It is not necessarily obvious that it actually is representative. It's far from clear, in fact, whether it's representative of actual voting patterns. And more importantly, I think the danger is that assuming that what's happening in Turkey, as you say, Turkey is anomalous on this. I'm not sure that something like this would necessarily happen in other, let's say, uncertain democracies, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, normally what I would say is that the big effect that this would have is that it would cause the rest of the world to notice that there were local elections in Turkey and care about how they were held and what the consequences are. But as noted, between the plane and Ukraine, I think he's going to have to do more than unsuccessfully ban Twitter, which is maybe sort of the natural segue to other things that people can't seem to get noticed for no matter what. So maybe then we move on to Venezuela.
Yes, which, you know, again, it was interesting how, you know, at least last month at this time, Ukraine and Venezuela in some ways, I think, commanded the equal amounts of, you know, media time, as it were, in part because the story seemed very, very similar in terms of what was happening. But ever since, you know, ever since the Ukraine protests led to where they were and then Russia stepped in, and then the Malaysian plane disappeared, I've seen less and less traffic about Venezuela. Part of this might be because the Venezuela case is a tougher one. Well, no, I mean, it's in some ways the same way you can parse out as the Ukraine protests. In the Ukraine protests, you had a lot of people who were very justifiably, you know, upset at the incompetence of Viktor Yanukovych. And you also had a few, you know, right fringe Ukrainian nationalist types that were very, very scary and anti-Semitic. In the case of Venezuela, you have a similar split in the opposition, although perhaps maybe the more interesting story is that clearly a larger fraction of the Venezuelan opposition really does want an extra legal move to take down President Maduro.
Well, you know, I think in defense of Venezuela getting less attention, there is, I think, a certain, you know, there have been a number, both under Maduro and under Chavez, of times where protests seemed to peak and people said, okay, is this the time that something
right.
extra legal or not extra legal is going to happen? And it didn't happen. And the government muddled through. And, you know, Maduro, to the extent that he has a reputation in the time since Chavez died, it is largely for muddling. And so I think I could forgive a certain amount of, yeah, well, these are just more demonstrations and there's always demonstrations, but they don't have it together this time and they didn't have it together last time and Maduro's not going anywhere. I suppose the interesting counter to that is that in some ways, because of energy, one could argue that a destabilized Venezuela has potentially got a much more significant and concrete impact on the rest of the world than a destabilized Crimea does. I don't know how far I want to take that, but there's at least some sort of element to it.
I mean, it's in the sense that it gets paired with this question of if you see continued tit for tat between the West and Russia, you know, over Crimea, would it eventually come to a point where either Europe boycotts buying Russian energy and or Russia decides we're not going to sell the energy to you anymore, at which point then you start looking around to see whether other sources of supply are will be able to compensate. The thing I'm actually genuinely surprised by, and again, this connects the two of them, is I'm actually surprised you aren't seeing more conservatives in Washington calling actually for more aggressive. I've seen calls for the United States to take a more active role in Venezuela, but I'm actually surprised no one has just gone out and said, well, all right, you know, if the new rules are great powers get to intervene in their neighborhoods, you know, willy-nilly, why can't we just literally intervene, you know, using force in Venezuela and actually get the government we want? I've rendered you totally speechless with that, haven't I?
Because I'm actually about to say something nice about the wing of Washington conservatives who've been most exercised about Venezuela.
Okay.
Well, that, and also that they understand that there's no appetite. Well, number one, they understand that there's no appetite for it. And number mm-hmm. two, they're not under the illusion that there's a fabulous, better government waiting in the wings. You know, yeah. the sort of Ahmed Chalabi delusion is not currently present in the Venezuelan case. And I think that explains it almost in its entirety, that there's not the illusion that there's a quick fix in Venezuela.
Well, in some ways, this is part of a larger, I mean, really, this, the most fascinating, you know, polling I've seen on Ukraine, on the U.S. response to Ukraine, is it's striking the extent to which there's not just no appetite for the United States to, you know, ratchet up the its pressure on Russia militarily. There's even actual, you know, there is a genuinely strong sentiment of saying, don't get involved, period, which I find actually really surprising, because the way most polling tends to work, if you give people three options, you know, in the case of Ukraine, you know, don't do any, you know, don't get involved, you know, consider putting troops on Ukraine's border or impose sanctions, they're generally going to take the middle course because that's always seen as the most moderate. But that's not the case in the polling on Ukraine, which is by and large, Americans don't want to get involved over there, which I think is of a piece with the reluctance, as you say, of conservatives to urge more aggressive action in Venezuela. This is increasingly a more powerful constraint on U.S. foreign policy than I think people appreciate.
So I agree with your conclusion that public opinion is a stronger constraint on foreign policy than most people appreciate or had appreciated up to 6-8 months ago. My read on the Ukraine polling is a little different. I saw more of the yes, let's sanction them. Yes, it's wrong what Russia's doing. No, we don't want to be sending troops over there. And I mm-hmm. also wonder whether something I worry about a lot in sort of the conduct of American diplomacy is that the public
discourse has gotten so limited that I honestly am not sure that it gets explained that there are options that are involvement that don't involve force. I honestly sometimes think that when you say engagement, yeah. people think you mean force. When you say involvement, people think you mean force. When you say
or intervention, it means force. Yeah.
Intervention, it all means force. And so then yeah. if you're going to say, no, I don't want any of that because I don't want force. But you're not saying, well, I don't really care what the Russians do and how that messes up European energy markets or how it affects my ancestral homeland or whatever, whatever.
I mean, I think you're right. And I would also say, you know, here's where I'll say something favorable for hawks with respect to Ukraine, which is very few of the, I mean, there's been no call for actual military force. You know, I mean, even John McCain is not saying, you know, use force to get the Crimea back or, you know, what have you. I mean, I think the most aggressive suggestion is basically that the United States starts selling actual military weapons to Ukraine rather than anything else. But I think you're right that in some ways one of the issues and here I'm going to be on this is where I actually do blame the Obama administration as well. The Obama administration, you know, particularly post-Hillary at State, have done a very bad job of trying to signal there are ways we will be involved that do not, you know, that don't involve, you know, the use of force, which I find interesting because this was in some ways one of the primary themes of Obama's you know, when he ran for president in both 2008 and 2012. But I haven't seen that case being made right now.
Something I think progressives consistently underestimated was how badly the discourse had gotten shrunk and dumbed down so that there isn't this understanding of a variety of tools. And I think fixing that would require a bigger investment in time spent talking to the public about this. And in the administration feels, you and I've had this argument before, feels yeah. like it has a limited, we should right. just have a clip we can refer viewers to so they don't have to see this again, but has a limited amount of time for it. I do think, I mean, someone at some point either takes on the challenge of doing this, really makes it one of the things that they do, or we sort of head irreparably into a late Rome tailspin that we can't recover from. And I hear the viewers already saying, yeah, we're already there. And I would like to think that we're not already there, but it's going to take a lot of effort. And I, you know, a lot of effort and not a lot of instant payoff because, you know, the options are not, I mean, like the options aren't very satisfying. And it's not satisfying to talk about things that aren't satisfying and still leave morally problematic outcomes in place or don't have 100% solutions. So, you know.
I'm sorry. I just had this image of Obama trying to address the country and trying to explain this and saying, now, I understand that these are not pleasant conversations to have. So I'm going to use the metaphor of Game of Thrones to explain what I think we should be doing in Ukraine, you know, and then allowing you to have the conversation about genre. But
do we have any evidence that Obama's ever watched Game of Thrones? Has he ever talked about it?
No, he's a House of Cards guy, if memory serves, which I don't think actually speaks terribly well of him.
That's actually what I find fascinating about that is that when I was just a miserable, not very senior staffer at the White House, the all White House related TV was banned in my home. We didn't watch West Wing because, yeah. I mean, I just spent all my time comparing it to reality, and my husband found it incredibly stressful. He said it's too much like listening to you talk about work. So it's for reasons completely unrelated to the merits of the shows. It's fascinating to me that you would relax by watching a show that's about what you spend 18 hours a day doing. But
that is a fair point.
Possibly that is why I am not any threat to anybody to become president of the United States.
I will just only add that, you know, as an academic, I don't have to worry about this at all, since no one has actually made an interesting show in quite some time about the Academy. My only complaint is that whenever there is whenever like a normal television show puts a character who, you know, becomes a professor or what have you, the only narrative trope that is predictable is that if the professor is a man, he inevitably sleeps with the student, which I'm not a huge fan of for obvious reasons.
I'm so not going there.
Yeah, thank you.
I mean, and it is interesting because actually Elisa Rosenberg just had a column in the Post, which
yes.
was pointing out that female journalists on TV shows about journalism and politics inevitably sleep with either male bosses or male sources. So in point
the doppelganger of this, I want Elisa to write, Elisa, if you're watching this, please, for the love of God, can you write the reverse one where it's always, you know, if you show the male professor inevitably sleeps with the student. And I think that's equally pernicious because, you know, it means there's a stereotype I have to fight as a professor, which, you know, is actually not the way the world works. It's certainly not the way the world works now.
Right. Well, and as Elisa pointed out, that's a stereotype that's a bummer for both halves because
yes,
it's a
exactly.
stereotype about how women progress in the world, which is not flattering to any of us, actually.
No. Yes, it's a great piece. And in some ways it touches on the House of Cards thing as well. So I highly recommend that you do that, that our viewers read that. But, I mean, let me ask you a question. If you did have the presidency here at this point, is there a way in which you think you could actually make a viable case for how a president or how an administration can put forward the idea of, listen, we are going to stay engaged in the world, but staying engaged with the world does not, you know, reductio ad absurdum go down to just the use of force. What we are going to do is a whole variety of other instruments, which might not cause Russia to give up the Ukraine right now, or give up Crimea right now, but actually in the long run build a sustainable foundation such that these sorts of actions will be few and far between.
I would have a paragraph that went in every stump speech that said, and it wouldn't have the word engagement in it, actually. And it probably wouldn't have the, might or might not have the word diplomacy in it. And it would say, the well-being of Americans is inextricably tied up with events outside our borders. And part of my job as president is making sure that we're acting outside our borders in ways that complement and mirror and reinforce what you're asking your leaders to do at home. And I would have that sort of little intro, and then I would have a rotating set of 6 or 8 or 10 little examples that I would slot into every speech, I'm enough of a realist not to say every speech, but
right.
I would be, you know, when I go to a factory in Illinois, I would add in sort of, and here's the 3 things that we're doing that are going to create more jobs and a better environment for you all. When I went to a school, I would say, you know, and here are some things that are relevant to kids overseas or how kids overseas are relevant to you. You know, maybe I would use that moment to talk about Syrian refugees. Maybe I would use it to talk about the damn plane. but always, 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 and especially in big set pieces like State of the Union, I would have my little chapeau paragraph that says, and just a reminder, there's a whole bunch of things that we do that relate back to the daily lives of Americans. And I would just get everybody used to framing it like that and not framing it in terms of engagement or diplomacy or grand strategy or all the tools in the toolbox or whole of government approach or all those other things that we love and that are all really important. And I'm not belittling them. I'm belittling them as rhetorical concepts because, you know, whole of government what? And of course, obviously the biggest tool you have is the military. So that again, you just fall right back into your trap. So that would be my rhetorical fix. There's also the matter of substantively, how do you muster the political oomph to fix the time imbalance and the funding imbalance and the competence imbalance after you spend a decade pouring all your best resources into your military?
Well, the other issue is, let's be blunt, it's Congress. A lot of what you would want to do and a lot of what's being tried to be done now in terms of developing a long-term response to this is going to require congressional approval. And, you know, little things like, you know, trying to get more money from the United States to the IMF so the IMF can help Ukraine. To do this, you want that IMF reform package, which, by the way, the U.S. essentially brokered in terms of the negotiations. You know, it suits our own interest to actually implement that. And yet, you know, and yet that's been a tough fight. You know, if that's a tough fight, God forbid what happens if you try to get something like TTIP or TPP through.
Yes. Dan, I need to be wrapping up. Actually, my computer has just binged at me. So, but it's reminding me actually that we should do a future show where we talk some more about the trade agreements and we really actually kind of go through. And actually, you know what we should do for viewers just for the heck of it is we should make you argue against them and me argue for them.
Ooh, I kind of like that. That might be good.
People complain that we don't disagree enough.
I didn't know people would complain that. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, I think the people are stupid. No, okay, whatever.
No. Our viewers are not stupid, and it would actually be really fun. So I challenge you for next time. You take on the anti-trade argument. I'll take on the pro-trade argument. We'll see how long we can go.
Challenge accepted.
And if we were on Game of Thrones, how would I lay down a challenge? Is there like an appropriate lingo that I would use or a dragon I would have or something?
You would probably stand up and proclaim what is dead may never die or something. You know, there's a whole bunch of catchphrases in Game of Thrones, which, you know.
May never die. Boy, I look really dumb standing up in my little office at the Human Rights Organization. And the people across, I have glass walls in my office, so the people across the hall from me think I'm nuts. That, Blogging Heads viewers, is what I am willing to do for you.
And that is devotion. I'm impressed.
And with that, until next time.
Until next time, Heather.